In the New South Wales Police Force, Gary Raymond was involved with investigating some of Sydney's major crimes, one of which was the murder of Australian politician John Newman. On the night of the 5th of September 1994, John Newman was shot in the car park near his home in the Sydney suburb of Cabramatta. John Newman's death was described by the press as Australia's first political assassination. It would be 7 years before the man behind the murder was convicted. This murder conviction took a long time, Gary. How come?
Well, it was quite a complex case, and yeah, I remember it well. I was working that particular evening, and the call came in, but and we didn't know what it was at first. It was alleged that someone had been shot, and others may have thought it was firecrackers, and that's quite common, actually. When you get calls to gunshots, they can be mistaken for fireworks. But we always go on the caution because you just don't know what you're driving or walking into. But, yeah, I knew John Newman personally from dealing with him around the streets of Cabramatta. He was the parliamentary member for Cabramatta, and he was actually born in Austria. And came here when he was age four, I think it was, and to sort of get out of that area at the time wasn't real good politically. And he moved in the area of Sydney and then moved away again and came back. But when he started in the council, so his political career started with local government, and he became interested in the Cabramatta area in particular because he lived in that area. And it was around, I think, 1977, he was on what they call now an alderman or councillor on the Fairfield Council. And I guess two things, when the European migrants came to Sydney, they stayed in the Villawood Migrant Hostel, and it was a natural progression for them to leave the hostel and just move a short distance to the Cabramatta Fairfield area. And after the Europeans stopped immigrating, of course, our friends from Vietnam started immigrating after the war there, usually boat people. And so they stayed at the migrant hostel and started to move over into Cabramatta and the Fairfield area.
My first church was at Villawood, which dated back to people coming from the detention centre.
When I was stationed in Cabramatta, and it was around the late 90s, or around getting towards 2000, but I was there for quite a few years before that. It was mainly Vietnamese. There was a smattering of Chinese, Thais, Cambodians. Quite a mixed, and some Europeans and Aussie Caucasians, of course. So it was a very, very mixed population there. And it started to take on, which it's got to this day, a very much an Asian flavour. There's Asian writing or characters, there's Asian shops and restaurants, particularly very good food, including my favourite, the Vietnamese soups. They're just amazing, the noodle soups. So there was quite a mixture there. But what happened was the youth in the area, the boat people, of course, settled down and had children. And these young Vietnamese Australians started to fantasise about a gang which was known in America around California, and it was called the 5T gang there, and they adopted that. So we started to get these youths clumping together and pretending they're sort of street gangs. So at first it started fairly loosely, and then by the way, 5T, I think, from memory, stands for love, money, prison, crime, revenge and death, or revenge or death. So the 5T had its own characteristic tattoos and so on. Now, after a while, these Vietnamese youth gangs, some of them became extremely... infantasisation became reality. They started to arm themselves with weapons. They started to take territory, and particularly and there was a certain portion of the gangs on the western side of Cabramatta and another portion of the Vietnamese / Cambodians on the eastern side of it. There was a railway line separating the two segments of the suburb. They started committing crime, and serious crime too, particularly drug importation was a big one, and heroin was the biggest one, and marijuana was there as well. But heroin was the big drug of choice, and they started to arm themselves with a whole array of weapons, knives, guns, particularly pistols, machetes. We got them in machetes, nunchuckers like the Asian weapons, swords even. And they started to stand over people. And extortion was one of the big crimes that they started to commit, telling shopkeepers that if they didn't pay the money, and sometimes substantial amounts, could be, you know, $500 a week. Otherwise, they would go in and trash the business and hurt the shopkeepers, the business owners. They would go into restaurants and have a feed and then just walk out without paying. And if the proprietor of the restaurant challenged them, they'd threaten to kill them or destroy their restaurant. And there was a couple of cases that we investigated where they actually started to physically assault the staff and other diners, patrons in some of these restaurants, very blatant and foolhardy. As well as the standard tactics, there was things like robberies. They would assault and rob people, or armed robbery of people for money or drugs or both. They started even kidnapping or abducting people and holding them for ransom sometimes, or just to assault them. They started prostituting, getting girls to prostitute, particularly those who were addicted to heroin, and they would prostitute, you know, for that, and they would be the pimps or the managers of them. So it was starting to really, really get out of hand. And when I arrived at Cabramatta in the late 90s, it was really hard to manage because we tried a number of times to get more police in the area. And at one stage, a senior police officer said to me, "Oh, you don't need more police. You need to be smarter in what you do." Well, I turned around and said, "Sir, with due respect, we are very, very smart. We need more smart police." And he didn't like that one little bit. But there was a political component fence in all this. The Cabramatta electorate, they voted Labor, I guess without, you could blindfold them, they'd still vote Labor, or you could put Mickey Mouse up as the candidate, they'd still vote Labor. Now, I'm not a political person at all, but that's just the truth of the matter. So the Labor government at the time didn't see the necessity to spend money and resources in the area because they were a sure vote anyway. And as much as we begged for more police, they continued not to supply those needs. And the other thing is too that with the crimes being, you know, by the 5T, they got a lot of money. So they were quite cashed up due to their drug selling and robbery and all the rest of it. So they had safe houses. They rent a number of properties around Cabramatta to one to live in and one to do the drug packaging in and so on. Even restaurants, they hired a restaurant on the east side. And there was no cooks in the kitchen. There was no patrons came into the restaurant. The heroin went in small bags or larger bags when it was obtained, before it was broken up into smaller bags, was actually hidden in rice, like uncooked rice. And it's funny having a restaurant with no cooks and no food being cooked.
Did people raise their concerns about that?
Well, we only found out about it as soon as we did a search warrant and found the drugs and arrested a number of individuals. But normally, no one would talk. You know, there was, because of Vietnam in particular, and I think other countries, there was a mistrust in the police in Vietnam, and I think Thailand and other places, it's quite well known the police are corrupt. And the more money you've got, the more service you get, or the more money you've got, the easier it is for you to get out of jail or have no charges or charges drop. So the Vietnamese population, I think, mistrusted us just as much as the 5G gang. That's not the case now. The area of Cabramatta now is one of the safest in Sydney, and it's an amazing place. I recommend people go and see Cabramatta. It's in the west southwestern suburbs of Sydney, and roughly it's not that far from the CBD. But it's, you literally walk in there and you think you're walking into Ho Chi Minh City or Saigon, with the signage and the different shops and restaurants, and there's lots and lots of things to see and do there. So this is the atmosphere in which we're in at the moment, in those days where it was just a shocking. And the other thing that was happening too was people were deliberately coming to Cabramatta to get their drugs. And it was well known that the train would stop at Cabramatta Railway Station, and they got a nickname, the Junkie Express. And the Junkie Express was, they'd turn up, go into the streets, or pubs or clubs or restaurants, and obtain, buy their drugs, get back on the train and leave. And so at times we used to man with police the railway station and just check why people were getting off and coming to Cabramatta. And many of them just got back on the next train and got out of there pretty quickly. The drug overdoses were unbelievable, and I don't know if people realise that a heroin or narcotic overdose suppresses your respiration. It acts on the brain and the little centre in the brain, which deals with breathing. It comes and lodges itself in there and stops the breathing mechanism working, so people literally can't breathe anymore and they suffocate. And the overdose renders them unconscious, or sometimes we would see them with what we call on the nod. That is, they'd be sometimes even literally standing and slumped in and sort of, you know, leaning in a doorway asleep under the influence of heroin. Others might be on the ground, of course, or sitting on a bus seat or somewhere, and they'd be asleep. I saw one particular fellow. He was drinking a milkshake, and he was on the nod. He had the straw in his mouth and in the milkshake, of course, and holding it and asleep.
Right.
And I went to check his welfare because, you know, they might stop breathing, and he woke up with a bit of a startle and dropped a milkshake. And all he could do was, you know, not thank me for helping him and getting the ambulance there to treat him. All he could do was whinge and whinge and whinge about his milkshake, that I caused him to spill his milkshake. And just to spite him, I actually went into one of the shops and got another milkshake. I said, "Here," I said, "stop your whinging. I've saved your life. You know, have another milkshake and try and drink it this time." And what happens is that we patrol, we call the ambulance to we'd find them in derelict buildings, in drains, in the bush, on the southern part of Cabramatta, the Cabramatta Creek precinct. And we'd get the ambulance down, and what the ambulance paramedics did was give them a drug called naloxone or Narcan, and that was injected and it travelled to the brain and got rid of the narcotic off the brain breathing control centre. And they used to often be 1 minute, nearly stop breathing, and within 30 seconds after an injection of Narcan, they wake up, and some of them might get quite aggressive. Others go into withdrawal because that, for those short moments, they're actually, the heroin's not affecting them. And so they go into drug withdrawals. And then if we leave them there, then it may take over again. So often the ambulance had to wait with them while they recovered, or take them to hospital if there was other issues on top of that. We sometimes, Vince, used to attend alongside, we used to always go alongside the paramedics in case there was violence. And we sometimes, do 10 to 12 dozen overdoses a day. That's one police car and one ambulance, let alone the others. And there was paraphernalia everywhere. Everywhere you looked, there were needles and, you know, syringes. There was little empty plastic bags. There were spoons. There was, you know, expelled cigarette lighters, because they used to put the heroin in a spoon with water and dissolve it, suck it up into the syringe and then inject it. And I saw some shocking, you know, things. People used to inject it after their veins in their arms were shot to bits because of the constant injecting. They'd go to other places. And some of the other places were, you know, in the corner of their eye or in the, and under their tongue, you know, anywhere where they could get a vein to get the heroin in. And saw some shocking things. It was just... And it was no age either. There was people of all ages getting heroin and taking heroin and marijuana as well, of course. They often use both. And it was just terrible. One day we were there patrolling and we had a police dog. We used to occasionally get a police dog to do an operation with us on the streets. And the dog went up to a pram and looking at mum and dad, they certainly were affected by heroin. And the little baby in the pram itself was asleep, and the dog was sniffing around and indicating very vigorously the pram. And so mum got the baby out of the pram, and we searched the pram and couldn't find anything. We searched their bags, and we searched them. And the dog jumped up on mum, controlled by the dog handler, of course, to just sort of jumped up and was sniffing. And we found the heroin hidden in the baby's nappy. Inside the baby's nappy. Well, I'll tell you what, it was just dreadful to see that. And we ended up arresting them, of course, and we called in the child welfare authorities, the department of, you know, to come and take the child. And it was just terrible. So just painting a picture of this place, which was absolutely running rife. There was murders there as well. There was fights between factions and the different gangs. And the dealing, every corner just about had a dealer on it, or every premises. And sometimes the dealers would hide the drugs in a local business. Like, for example, they'd walk into a fruit shop and they'd stand over the owner there and hide their drugs in there and deal from the fruit shop. And so they didn't have to carry the drugs on them. And they were often couriers to carry the drugs. One day we got a 13-year-old paper boy knocked off his push bike by car accidentally. And the kid was unconscious and the paramedics were treating the child with severe head injuries. He's never helmet on like a bicycle hard hat. And we needed to search him and his bag to see if there was any ID there so that number one, we knew who he was, secondly, we could notify his parents. As we went through the bag on the back of his bike, we came across a package of heroin, just under a kilo of heroin. Now, that's worth absolute thousands and thousands of dollars. And we found $300 in his pocket. And later on, of course, when he became conscious and got over his head injury, we interviewed him in front of his parents, and he admitted that he'd been given $300 to transport this package, which he knew was drugs, in, you know, age 13, from the west side of Cabramatta across to the east side. And the fights again used to do that. They'd get young people or children to transport drugs so that they themselves would not be caught with it. The dealers were very clever at the way they concealed the drugs. The snooker rooms in the hotels were a favourite spot where they'd hide the drugs either in a wall, in the toilet, or sometimes strap them with sticky tape or masking tape under the snooker tables or under other tables or under chairs. And so we would do thorough searches and often find drugs in these public places, but it was good to always recover them. So it was really dangerous for police and for the citizens of Cabramatta. In this was John Newman. John Newman was a fellow who was very keen to clean up the area, because it was his electorate. And he did often threaten the 5T gang members. And John was a martial arts exponent as well. So he could handle himself physically if required, and they knew that. And he used to chase them off the streets or threaten them. He spoke to the parliament, he spoke to ministers, he spoke to everyone he could think of about getting resources into Cabramatta, and not only law enforcement resources, but health resources too, to deal with the addicts and try and get them into rehab and detox and rehab. And he tried vigorously to clean the place up, and he got some support, but not the support that he needed financially to get more police and more resources. So he was fighting a battle, and often he was known to have public meetings and berate the 5T gang and threaten them that he was going to bring resources in and close them down. And so there became enmity between John and the 5T. They could see that he was certainly very serious in getting rid of them. And of course, that would have taken all their income and their crime. At one stage, they did start a task force, which was aiming at dealing with these dealers, but it wasn't resourced as well as it could be. Now, the gang itself, 5T, at that time had about 40, roughly what you'd call full-time members, if you like. But then they had these around 200, we think, other people who were associates for the gang who would not be, entrenched within them, but would do things for them for money or dob others in and so on. And so we're dealing with a fairly... they actually outnumbered the police at Cabramatta at that time. And so not that that worried us too much. We had resources. But so this fight around March... In the year that he died there, around 94, he spoke to the Minister of Police to try and get resources there, and he started to get threats from the 5T over the phone on his answering machine.
This is John Newman?
Yeah, John Newman, yep. In his electoral office. But
yep.
He told us about them, but he didn't take them seriously. He thought he was untouchable, being a Member of Parliament, and he thought, knowing that he had the support of the police, that he would be sort of almost untouchable, I suppose, as I said. And he even went, John was so passionate getting rid of these gangs, he went to Los Angeles and had a look at the gangs there and what the police were doing, what the community was doing, to try and get some answers for this. He was living with his fiancée, Lucy Wang, and Lucy was from China. And she was certainly intent on marrying John, and they were living together in Wood Street at Cabramatta. Well, came the night of his death. I was just patrolling, and it was just a bit after 9:30. We got a call via our communications, any current vicinity, Wood Street, Cabramatta. We have a report that the Member of Parliament, John Newman, has been shot. And so that's, as soon as you hear that on the police radio, if this is true, then this is big. This is absolutely huge. And so we, of course, lights and sirens, went to the scene. I was the senior sergeant working by myself at that time, and another amazing policewoman was the senior, well, was the chief supervisor at Cabramatta on the way. I arrived at the house, and the sergeant there, Tracy, had just arrived as well. And there was two young police officers, uniformed police officers, down the driveway of John Newman's home. And John was on his back, and they were doing CPR on him. And I noticed Lucy Wang, his fiancée, was on the front step, sitting on the front step of their house, absolutely screaming. And I mean, sorry, not screaming, I would call it shrieking, just shrieking with fear and anxiousness. And what happened was, he'd had some vandalism on his car, and then he'd had some paint thrown at one stage. So he got a car cover, and he just arrived home, and Lucy came out of the house. He'd been to a meeting, I think it was a Labor Party meeting or a community meeting, and around 9:29 or somewhere like that. And he was putting the cover over the car, and Lucy was on the southern side sort of thing, and he was on the northern side, and they're putting the cover over to try and protect it from any paint attacks again. And then a vehicle, which was described as a green vehicle, or sort of a light green, you know, aqua type vehicle, pulled up, and a bloke ran out and aimed a pistol at John and fired four shots. Two of them hit him. The first one sort of went into, I think from memory, the left side. I'm just trying to think back. I think it went in the left side of his chest. Yeah, that's right. He was standing facing his car with his arms up, putting the cover over, and the shot from the top of the driveway by this individual went through the left side of his chest and out the other side. That spun him around, and the second shot got him through the right side of the chest, and the other two shots missed John himself. He then fell straight down onto the driveway, and you can imagine he was critically ill. When the police arrived, he was obviously, he'd lost his life, he was dead, but they decided to do what we call traumatic resuscitation, try and at least save his life. And when I arrived, I ran down the driveway, and they were resuscitating John, and then I realised, okay, where's the gunman? Who's done this? You know, where's the offender or offenders? And so I then knelt beside the two young police officers resuscitating John and pulled out my gun and just scanned the horizon carefully with it to cover should something happen. Because at that stage we didn't know. We realised he'd been shot because we saw the cartridges in the driveway. And so we didn't know. And that was a scary moment for him, not knowing. Well, did Lucy shoot him? Did a neighbour? Did someone else? A drive-by? I didn't know at that stage. So as I covered them, I just glanced down, and being a former ambulance officer, we'd torn his shirt open so we could expose his chest to do the compressions. And I noticed that one of the wounds in the side of his chest was leaking fluid and blood. And I knew then that the bullet had gone straight through both lungs and of course his heart in the middle of his chest. But we kept going, and more police arrived and the ambulance arrived, and of course they did a cardiac tracing on him and found that it was flat line. In other words, there was no chance of him sustaining life. We then started to do inquiries, of course, talking to neighbours. We then sealed off the crime scene for awaiting forensic evidence, and the coroner opened all of those resources. We knew this was big, and a short time later, Paul Keating, who was the Prime Minister at the time, he was in Japan, and he rang the crime scene. And I remember thinking to myself, wow, you know, things get really quick. They talk about the gossip. And things go very quickly. He found out. He was notified by his parliamentary colleagues. In other words, the news travelled very, very quickly. And of course, John Fay, who was the Premier at the time, he found out about it quickly as well. And we notify these members of Parliament when something significant happens, so they've got enough money.
And John Newman was in the Labor Party?
Yeah, John Newman was a Labor politician,
right.
and that's where he got pre-selection for the Labor Party and won it there. And So we set the crime scene out, and it took quite a while, as you can imagine, for the trace evidence to be gathered, to photograph. The ballistics experts were there, other forensic experts. And so we were just at the scene, taking the names of neighbours and others to get statements from them as soon as we could, because it's always good to get statements when it's fresh in somebody's memory. So I'll never forget one of the things that was, we finished the scene, and we were waiting then for the what we call the government contractors, which is the funeral director that has the government contract to pick up coroner's bodies. And so we were waiting there. Next thing I heard, a car abruptly stopped, and a fellow got out with an elderly lady, and they ran towards the driveway. And before we could even respond, they run past us, under the tape, down to John's body. And I found out it was his mother, Mrs. Niemenko. And because John had changed his name from Niemenko to Newman, because he thought within the political arena and the community, number one, Newman was easier to spell, and number two, he would be, it would sort of Australianise his name for political, you know, advertising, all the rest of it. But Mrs. Niemenko ran down, and she fell through and fell herself on top of John's body. And I'll never forget her crying and crying and crying. And with that, we were able then to help her up, and we took her down towards their house, John's house. And I just told one of the police officers, number one, call an ambulance just to check it out. So the investigation started, and quite interesting that Lucy Wang, sitting on the step, screaming out, this was full no. She nominated full no within minutes of the shooting, that he had to be involved. And at that stage, we had no evidence whatsoever of that. But we started investigating it. Now, Phong Ngo was from Vietnam, and he came here after the fall of Saigon, and took up residency. He was only a young man when he turned up here, but he got quickly involved in politics and local affairs. He became on the council. And he actually ran against John Newman for the elections for the electorate of Cabramatta, and John won the seat in Parliament. And Phong Ngo never got over that, because he was involved in some pretty chonky things with the Mekong Club. The Mekong Club is a registered club in John Street, Cabramatta, and was a central meeting place for gangs, the 5T. And he thought he would have won, because being of Vietnamese origin, that he thought, well, you know, they'll vote for me. But they voted for John. And he was extremely resentful about that. And so he started then plotting to get that seat from John Newman, from Parliament, a seat in Parliament. He was involved in certainly the vandalism, you know, the vandalism of the car through the 5T. And he was looking at opportunities, and he started then to canvass the 5T gang as to assassinating John Newman. They had meetings together, and then they had a couple of attempts. The attempts weren't... coming back to Phong Ngo, he was actually captured by the communists. He was in, I think, camps in Malaysia and other places. He escaped. And he ended up in Sydney around 1989, I think it was, in Cabramatta. So he had a very tough upbringing and tough life. But he then started to talk to the 5T gang members, selected members, about taking out John Newman. And they actually had it lined up on three, I think, from memory. They were going to shooting in the fire, in the just leaving the Mekong Club at one stage after a meeting. But there was, he was with a bunch of six or seven other councillors and other members of the community, so they aborted that. another time they were going to shoot him in, when he got in the car park just before he got his car, and that was abandoned because of people around. And they finally decided to shoot him when he arrived home after a meeting in the driveway of his house. But interestingly enough, when they were planning this, Faulkner was seen in his car a couple of streets away, or a street at the back of John Newman's house. So he was sussing out the area so that they could hatch a plan. But he was seen by neighbours there, because he was a high profile, they knew him. And so that gained some pretty vital evidence for the investigators, that's for sure. We found out too that he paid quite a bit of money, or offered a bit of money for the assassination of John. You know, quite a large amount of money. I think there was rumoured from memory around $30,000, or could have been even more than that. And they obtained the gun, and it was a 32 caliber, what they call a flat firing pin pistol, not a revolver, a pistol, and that was pretty rare. It was, I think, came from Germany, or that came from Italy, I should say. And so they also obtained a rifle, and they tried to get a silencer, but it wouldn't fit the gun or the rifle, and so they had to use it as it was. And what they did, they waited for John to get home, and there was three of them in the car. There was a fellow called Ding, Dow, and Tran. Well, the driver was Tran bought the guns for them, got the guns, and Dow was the shooter, and Ding was the driver. They were waiting down the road in a good position where they could see John arrive home, but no one could see them. And so they concealed them. They drove up, and because he jumped out of the vehicle and then shot John, as we just said. They then sped off. Yeah, the gang gave the gun to Fongno, and he then drove down towards the Cooks River, and he dumped it off a bridge there. And it was interesting too that later on, when the investigation started to get real good legs, they did a triangulation of Fungo's phone. Now, early in the piece, they'd interviewed him just after the shooting, and he told a number of lies, which were then discovered later. He said that he wasn't in certain places, but his phone was pinging through triangulation to being particularly where the gun was dumped. And the police divers took a day and, I think it was a day and 20 minutes to find the gun. And it was a little bit corroded, but they could still do ballistic testing. It was actually taken over to Germany, the gun, and until some further ballistic testing took place. And they matched, which was a great, advance. They matched the shells to the gun, and so that's ballistically beautiful evidence. And so with the phone taps, and then finally, they had a crime commission look at the thing. Now, crime commission is an inquiry where the witnesses have to tell the truth, otherwise they're jailed for not telling the truth. And also they're compelled to answer. But unfortunately, the evidence in a crime commission is not really acceptable, in a court of law, in a criminal court. Also, 4 years later, there was a coroner's inquest. And one good thing about a coroner's inquest is hearsay evidence is allowed. And so Ding, Dow, and Tran then gave evidence to both of those inquiries, and the full story came out that they were involved. But and so when it went to trial, unfortunately, the shooter and the driver, and the one who obtained the gun, those three couldn't be convicted because, number one, there was no one giving evidence against them. And I guess the fear factor came in there, but the forensic evidence and other evidence was whereof the commit full note of trial, and the jury found him guilty of murder. He was then given life without parole, sentenced by the judge, and he remains in jail today. So the other thing is too, I guess, with all of this, being the first political assassination in Australia, it made huge headlines, and the government at the day then woke up to themselves and said, well, I think we've got a problem with Cavanaugh, like we've just had the Member of Parliament shot. And so they sent a young parliamentarian out, Reba Maher, to look after the area, and they then got a number of really good resources through the local government. The Fairfield Council put in a CCTV system, cameras all over the streets, and they constructed in John Street a little control room, if you like, a monitoring room manned with security company officers. And so we would sit there and watch the cameras, and if we saw something suspicious, out we'd go and catch them in the act a lot of the time, and other times we knew where they were going by following the cameras. And so things started. It was called Operation Puccini. And being involved in that was good because we had the resources, we had the freedom to do what we do best as police officers on the streets. And it wasn't long before the 5T gang was disintegrated, and it doesn't exist today. And I certainly hope it never exists again. So a number of the leaders were shot dead by each other, and it certainly was a great thing when the 5T were eliminated from that amazing suburb. But the driver, Dow, and Ding, the shooter, it's amazing that they couldn't be convicted because the jury had no evidence. People were too scared and they couldn't give evidence against each other, and so they're now free. But as I always say, as a Christian, God, they're not really free, because we're told in God's word in many places that those who commit such sin, and that's what it is, we call it crime, but God calls it sin, and will eventually be convicted by God if they don't turn to Jesus in the meantime, and end up in hell for eternity. That place where God was ordained, because he can't have sin and unrighteousness in heaven. When Jesus died, he took all the sin on himself to pay the price. And so those who reject that, sadly and regrettably, have to go to hell for eternity. And people say, well, how can a loving God do that? Well, because he is loving, and he's a God of justice. And I know it's not palatable to some people, but God's God, and we're us. And so we certainly appreciate God's justice. And so the whole thing changed there now, and as I said earlier, it's a fabulous place to go and visit. It's a real, experience to go to the restaurants and the fabric shops and the arcades with beautiful fruit and vegetables, meat, seafood, really good healthy stuff. So if you're doing nothing, go to Cabramatta.
There's a lot of people that think that hell is just for, the people that do very serious crimes, like the murderers, etc. What would you say to that?
Mankind puts levels on sin and different consequences of sin and crime and unrighteousness. But in God, it's all the same. Like, I'll give an example. As a police officer, I arrested people for shoplifting something that might have been worth $10. At the same time, I arrested murderers. Coming back to pinching something, whether it's worth $10 or if you pinch something that's worth $500, under the law, it's still what we call larceny. Larceny is stealing. And so whether you steal a penny or a pound, it's still, under the law, stealing. And there's different penalties, of course, but there is still a penalty, no matter what the variety of those penalties might be. In God's eyes, whether it's a penny or a pound, it's still sin against him. And, you know, coming back to the serious crimes, whether you murder one person or 50 people, it's still, in God's eyes, murder. And it's still, in the law's eyes, murder. There are different counts of murder, but it's still murder. And so I just say to people, look, offences against God are offences against God. And we might try and justify them. I remember I was talking to a youth group and I gave them a hypothetical. And I said, let's say we've got a fellow in a laneway and he's starving. And you see over a fence in a neighbour's house this beautiful apple or orange tree, or, you know. And so what do? You jump the fence, you take some fruit and you jump back over and you give it to this starving man. Is that wrong? Is that sin? Is that stealing? Some said, yes, it is. But most of them said, no, it's not stealing, because you are justified in jumping the fence, getting the fruit and giving it to a man starving. And I said to them, well, which one of you would have, you know, knocked on the front door and said, excuse me, sir, but out the back of your place in the laneway there's a man starving. Do you mind if we give some oranges and apples to him? 99.9% of people said, oh, for sure, just a minute, don't worry about that, I've got some really good food here. And I said, so what you did, even though you justified it, was stealing. Now, a lot of what we do against God, we try and justify, and there's things, not only things we do, but things that we don't do, that we should do. And so God looks at it as, it's not justified. We can't justify it. It's sin against him. But you know what? It's fantastic good news. We call it the gospel, which is good news, that Jesus died to pay the price for everything wrong that we've done, doing and going to do. He took the penalty. He took the wrath of God on himself so that we could then be totally offence-free. And so one day when we go before God, it's going to say, your fines have been paid for, your record's empty, your offences on your sin record or criminal record, if you like, is on Jesus' record. So come in and enjoy life eternally with me, because you accepted my son, you accepted and thanked him for doing that for you, and so I love you, and come in here for eternity. And so we find too that the Bible says that people who say they haven't sinned against God are liars. They're covering up. They know they have. Everyone knows, you know, that they've either told a lie, stolen something, looked at someone with lust, and all of those things, blaspheming God in by name. And they know, because God says he's written his laws in our hearts. We know when it's right and wrong. And also, we've got our conscience, which God speaks to and says, don't do that. Don't you do that or do that. And we go ahead and disobey him, and they're called trespassers. And so I love that part in what they call the Lord's Prayer, although it's really the disciples' prayer, isn't it? It says, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive those who trespass against us.
That's wonderful news. And I guess a lot of people don't know, but the basis really of our law system goes right back to the Ten Commandments, doesn't it? You as a policeman were really enforcing God's commandments.
Yeah, look, that's right. Every single statute, criminal statute, can be traced back to the Ten Commandments. And he gave us a guide. You know, he didn't leave us to make up our own laws. I mean, a lot of people try and make up their own laws. They try and structure their life on what they think's right and wrong. And often, you know, things like having marital affairs, you know, and sexual misconduct and sexual sin. And they can soon try and make up their own rules. They make up their own way of life. And God says, no, that's not, it's going to hurt you. Not only hurt you now, but it's going to hurt you in eternity. And I often say, it's PP. You know, we're going to pay for the party if that's who we are. And eventually, you know, it's like some billionaires and millionaires who don't know Christ. they're enjoying an absolute life of luxury and thinking, well, you know, this is great, but they're going to pay for the party because they've rejected Jesus and rejected what he's done to forgive them their sin. And even a poor man who's sleeping in the park and got nothing at all, not a thing, maybe a drinker or a non-drinker, will eventually again have to face God with their sin and unrighteousness. But as I said, there's a way out. There's one way, and that's Jesus. And there's an escape. There's an escape from the penalty of our sin and our dismissing God. There's an absolute way out, a way of escape. And so we just ask that people take that. And the way of escape is the doorway called Jesus.
Yes, Romans tells us about who is the way of escape. The book of Romans says, but God commended his love towards us in that while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us.
Yeah, look, you're right too. And that's amazing in itself, that he would not say to us, Vince, like, righto, clean yourselves up, get yourselves ready. I'm not having anything to do with you till you're nice and clean and sin-free. Well, if that was the case, we'd never, ever, ever get to know him, would we?
No, that's right.
But he says, no, hang on a minute. You can't clean yourself up. You can't forgive your own sin, but I can clean you and forgive you. And so that's what's amazing. Whilst we're yet sinners, Christ died for us. And same as us as police officers too. When we get calls, I mean, I've had some pretty nasty criminals, and they've been involved in a car crash, which is not their fault. And I've turned up and I've helped them. I've done my pre-hospital care and looked after them. And so I didn't say, oh, I know you. You're a crook. You're a criminal. Bad luck. You know, I'm leaving here. And you fix yourself up. I didn't judge him. I didn't stereotype him. I was there because I wanted to help him and I wanted to, you know, to heal his wounds with first aid and so on. And that's what it means, that whilst we're yet sinners, that is, enmity to God, he came and Christ died for us. Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing, definitely. Well, thank you for speaking with us today, Gary. I've been speaking with retired Chief Inspector of Police, Gary Raymond, and I look forward to our next podcast. Thank you, Gary.
Thank you, Vince. Thank you, everyone.